Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Hey, you. Have you checked out my book, In Defense of Ska, yet? It was one of Rolling Stone's top recommended picks in June of 2021. Esquire magazine called it an excellent read, and GQ said that it was an intelligent look at the much maligned genre and its various waves. So what are you waiting for? Get yourself a copy of In Defense of Ska right now at clashbooks.com. Ska bands had no chance of making it in the 2000s. Wait, there is one band that proves this theory false, and that is Boston's Big D and the Kids Table, who formed in the mid-90s and released their debut album No Luck in 1999, just as the mainstream lost its taste for the genre. While Big D didn't score a hit single at the same level as the Bostones circa 1997, their 2006 album, Strictly Rude, did crack the Billboard charts, a remarkable accomplishment considering that people were desperately hiding their ska roots at the time. Big D have had a prolific career, and they're back with a brand new album called Do Your Art. Lead singer Dave McWane joins us to talk about the band's long and interesting career.
So I had never thought of this until this exact moment right now. And I should have asked this of Dave, but is Big D, is that Dave?
So what I've read is that it's just like a name somebody came up with and just suggested it, and then that was it.
I wonder if anybody calls Dave Big D, though.
If somebody doesn't call him Big D, like, what's wrong with their lives?
Somebody should call him Big D. I'm going to call him Dave Big D next time I see him, and I'm going to get a bad look from him.
He's clearly Big D.
Everybody call Dave Big D from now on.
And does that make the rest of the band the Kids Table, like the backing band?
No, the Kids Table is just like the stage that they're on.
Oh, okay.
They are just the children at the Kids Table.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, see, we're getting deep here.
I want to ask you first about this cover you did in, I think it was 2004. It was The Specials' Little Bitch. I feel like this has come up multiple times. People have brought up Big D in different contexts and view that cover quite favorably, which is... It seemed like a pretty bold move to make to begin with, to go for a Specials cover.
Definitely.
I want to ask about the video, but first tell me about the decision to go for the Specials in mid-2000s.
Okay, so basically there's this bar in Cambridge called Charlie's Kitchen.
Yeah.
And a lot of us go on the second floor up there. And it has a jukebox, and every single time I'd go with my friends, I'd put a lot of money, you know, just I'd try to play it like five times. Because it's hard to get your song to come on. And if you're there for a while, what I found, I kept leaving and my song would come on, right? So it kind of turned into like me versus the jukebox. Like I just wanted to hear the song at least once each time I go to this bar. So I'd sink the money in and sit down. But then some nights, you know, if people didn't go to the jukebox much, it would play like five times. You know what I mean? So then it would play a lot. And my buddy John Hills finally turns to me and goes, dude, why do you do this every time? Why don't you just cover the song in Big D and just be done with it? And I went, oh, I didn't realize that. That's a great idea. So it was just like a song that, like, you know, I just would always try and play. And this is before, you know, cell phones and like having every song all the time with you. So it was a place like I didn't have the song, I didn't have the record, you know. And so I would just always try to play it when I was around it, you know. And so we covered it. And I think my excitement, like when we covered Operation Ivy's Energy, we totally knew that we were like stepping on sacred ground. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's almost like, don't do it. We're like, we know, but we're going to do it because we love it. But with the specials, I think I was so excited and I didn't even think like maybe it would be a bad idea. You know what I mean? It was just excitement. But you're right. Sometimes covering the holy songs can get you in a lot of trouble.
But also covering something like The Rudiments, you end up shining a light on a band that maybe people haven't heard of.
And that was the point of that. Like sometimes when Big D writes, like with the new record and some things, I see bands that I love, like the Dead Milkmen and things like even the Violent Femmes, you know, just less around. Like if you went up to your average, you know, 14 or 15 or 16 year old, 17 year old, they might not know those bands, which is crazy. So I kind of started smelling in the air that the Rudiments just weren't around anymore. And the song is just so good that I felt like it was just a way of continuing their art and letting people know that this band is here, did write that, you know what I mean? Just, I wanted to keep them up, you know what I mean? And then play it all the time because it's fun.
Yeah. It's a great song.
Oh, it's such a good song. Yeah.
Am I to assume correctly then that, that Little Bitch is your favorite special song?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's just so good. It's so good. And it's still, ours is so much faster that like it, even though it is a well-received cover, which is really nice, their pocket is still theirs. You know, that pocket that they own, you know, we don't do that pocket, you know? So I still enjoy very much so their version. And I finally got it on vinyl.
You know, you still request it 5 times at the local bar.
That's a good point. Like next time I go to Charlie's, I'll do it again.
So where did you film the video? Did you film the video there?
It was such an interesting time because you brought up like the actual date, like 2004 or something,
yeah,
right? Yeah. So like, as I think you're, you know, maybe alluding to, like ska is just not popular. You know what I mean? Like it's you know, Big D spent a lot of our time in the doldrums of the ska scene, which we like. And so we're about to start a tour, and I'm in California, and I was just visiting a buddy. And so I'm heading to tour and I'm telling him, I got this idea for this Little Bitch video because I'm still going on about it because he used to go to the bar with me. So it was relevant. And I was like, I'm thinking about doing this one shot take video. And he's a big Quentin Tarantino fan. And I'm a big Quentin Tarantino fan. And that's why I'm telling him because, you know, he likes film and we talk about film a lot. And so I described it to him and he says, sounds great. And so then I go on the tour and it's in Michigan with Suburban Legends and of course Mustard Plug, and it's the end of the first show, which is funny if you ever go on tour for someone on the tour to go, all right, I got this great idea. We'll get about 40 beers and it's at the end of the gig too. So describing people what was in store for the Little Bitch video was a lot like describing to the band Big D when I presented the idea for LAX. Like you're explaining something that they're like, what are you talking about? You know? And so I'm saying to the promoter, yeah, we just need about like 20 beers on this side of the camera and 20 beers on this side of the camera. These guys are going to hand the beers. We're just going to do it one take. And so everyone's just like, everyone's game, you know, it's kind of late at night and it's kind of hilarious and no one really knows what's going to happen. And we just did one take and that was it. And it's just better than perfect. If that's, that's possible.
Let's review who's in the video. I know, Dan Ponhast is clearly in the video. I think I see a few Suburban Legends, mm-hmm. Ryan Eldred from Catch 22.
Yep.
I think, okay. Anybody else?
Oh, well, it's Mustard Plug and Suburban Legends, Brian Clem, Vince from Suburban Legends. And then when the guitar solo comes in, like all the band members jump in.
Is it only band members or are there just randos in there too?
There could have been like a tour manager, but from my memory, it's band members. Yeah.
So you already said it was real beer, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Any idea how many beers you drank during that shoot?
Well, this is before I realized people would later see the video and comment negatively on my beer chugging skills. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just kind of like doing it, you know, just, hey, this is funny. And, you know, I've never been, you know, I mean, I watched Revenge of the Nerds a lot, but I was, you know, I've never, you know, chugged beers like people in those videos, movies. But like So once people started commenting, like, you're not very good at that, are you? I started to kick it into gear. So I think in that one, I only do like two or three, you know what I mean? I try to make people proud and my, you know, myself proud. And after people were, you know, commenting on my beer drinking.
But there was about 40 to go around for everybody.
Well, like it's hard to know how many. I would say at least 15 on both sides, but you know, I think it would be more. So a lot of beer gets drank.
You also have to lip sync throughout the whole video though too. So it's not like you can be pounding beers while there's vocals.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, even at my best, I'm not that great at it, you know. But Ryan from, yeah, Catch 22, you're right. He is on the left, and he does an outstanding job.
Excellent, excellent beer drinker. Did you say the name of the venue or the place that it was at? Do you recall?
It's, you know, I want to say like the Bluebird Theater, but I think that's in like a different place. I used to know, but it's just been such a long time. It used to be like a place we'd go often, but I just kind of forget.
Yeah, Bluebird's in Denver.
Denver, yeah. So, I mean, most of the Big D guys know, like, if you were like December 3rd, 1998, they'd be like, we were in this place, this place, this place. They know perfectly. But like, so many clubs are called like the Furnace. You know what I mean? That, yeah. Like, after a while, I'm just like, I don't know.
The underground.
Yeah, the underground.
The underground always ends up being a Christian youth center.
Yeah.
So the new album will be released by the time this podcast is released, October 22nd. And the very first single you put out is Too Much, right?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about this song. This was your first statement in a while to the people. Part of the song sounds like you're talking about that you're a little much to handle. And then part of it is like claiming that, you know, ska is a lifestyle. It doesn't matter what anyone thinks. Like those are seem like two messages in the song.
Yeah. I think the song is creative inspirationally by maybe three or four different avenues. Like, so definitely the I am too much for people. You know, I've just, throughout my life, I've always kind of found some of the most uncreative people or most unadventurous people try to hold back the most creative people and the most adventurous people I know. You know what I mean? Just like, don't, no, you're wrong. Don't do it, you know? And so it has something to do with that, you know, just people who are a little too scared to put their arms out and run into a field. You know, they'd be like, oh, but what if I trip? But what if there's bugs? But what if, but what if, but what if? You know what I mean? So it is commenting on people negatively trying to hold back people who want to move forward. But then it also has to do with, you know, Big D has always been too much for the genre. You know, like, you know, traditional ska people can be as traditional. This traditional ska scene can sometimes be as judgmental as the jazz scene. The jazz scene can be pretty judgmental. Like, you are not good and you need to go away. You know what I mean? And so we were always too punk for the traditional people. And so we were always too much for them. So it's just like this, you know, Big D's been going on for over 20 years. So it's a huge part of my lifestyle to have people be like, no, too much. You know what I mean?
You are a band that does play like really fast, punky, you know, music, but you also do play traditional ska well. And that is a part of your repertoire too. And like a lot of the ska core bands don't necessarily have a good handle on traditional ska too. So I can see how maybe you might be a band that some traditionalists like and some don't like because of that.
Yeah. Too punk, too ska for the punks and too punk for the skas. It's always been, you know, it's always been our kind of our rep. And then it keeps going because like I've been watching a ton of stand-up comedy. I like to I think stand-up comedians are the new punk rockers, the new punk rock scene currently. More so than the genre of music. And so they're going on about like, what's too much to say? You know, where's the line? A lot of them are doing of where's the line of where a joke can go, like freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And so a lot of them are talking about too much. Because I look up to a lot of these comedians, like I look up to bands, because of old bands I like because of their bravery, I just really respected, like the punk scene, them pushing it and them trying to find the line and try to or discover, is there a line? And so it has a lot to do with them. And I really do applaud them for, you know, being brave. You know, Big D has spent so much time getting on stage going, wait, did they get a load of this? They're going to hate it. You know what I mean? Like, it's the old heavy metal mantra of not wanting to go on stage to entertain people, but wanting to go on stage to just like prove you and your guys, you and your team are fucking badass. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I think there's a difference. Some people make sugar and some people make hot sauce. You know, everybody likes sugar, so everyone will devour it. But some people like hot sauce. And at first, people don't like hot sauce, and it takes a couple times for them to get used to it, but then they eventually love it. And I always think Big D's like hot sauce. And so, yeah, it's just kind of like getting up there and showing what your soul sounds like through music, you know?
Let's talk a little bit about the formation of Big D. The band started in 95, correct?
I think it's like 96.
Okay, 96. Yeah. So ska's going strong. You guys form a couple things. First off, you guys go for a 10-piece band with five or six horns?
I think, yeah, five. Yeah, I think.
Okay.
You might be right.
Let's talk about that.
Well, the reason all those people are in the band, it's because that was 100% of our friends, our crew. You know what I mean? And I originally was on drums. The three of us, Mark, Steve, and I, we started the band. Mark on guitar, Steve on bass, and me on drums. And we were just playing Operation Ivy covers. That was just what we wanted to do together. And, you know, my friends and I, we were limited on, like, girls who would think to talk to us, and we were too young to buy beer. So, you know, the only thing we had was music. And so eventually each person was like, where are you guys going? Are you guys going to go do that practicing again? And we'd be like, yeah. And they're like, well, can we come? And we're like, of course. And so we didn't have a vocalist for a really long time. Most of Shot by Lammy was written. And eventually Mark just said, dude, Max, we'll have Max play drums because he has nothing to do when we all hang out and you just sing. And I'm like, well, I don't have any singing hope. Like, I wasn't interested in singing at all. It'd be like if someone randomly said, like, we want you to be a shark diver. And you're like, shark diving? Why would I do that? And so I did it. And he said, he and the guys said, we just think you'd be good at it. So I thought that was nice of them. And, you know, I went home and wrote some lyrics to Shot by Lammy that didn't have lyrics yet. And I was really, 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 really nervous and just did it. They liked it.
When do you feel like the band really kind of got going? Like, you know, to where you had a repertoire of songs, you had a pretty good live set, you were gigging regularly?
Geez. You know, I would say like after our, like when I felt like we were a well-oiled machine. Is that what you mean?
No, more not necessarily. Like, not the question isn't so much when do you feel like you were your best. More when do you feel like the band got serious? In the sense that you were, you know, it was beyond just being friends hanging out. That you had songs. That you were gigging. That you were trying to make something out of it.
I don't think we ever really want to try to make anything out of it.
No. Okay, well, you did release an album. You did release your debut album, Good Luck, on Asian Man. So what was the status of the band going into that release? Were you, obviously, that must have been a big deal.
Okay, so the mindset of Big D is I'll go back to the Asian Man thing, but the general mindset of Big D is not to become a huge band. That in no way. You know, I don't go to those huge stadium shows. You know what I mean? Like, I unless it's Iron Maiden, I just really like rehearsals. The band's always really like music and making music, writing music, recording music, listening to music, talking about music. But being like a big band with guitar techs and And that isn't really, that's not what Big D considers. You know, I like shows that are like 50 people, 150 people, 300, 500, 1,000 starting to get to be a little too much. Once it gets to 15, once it becomes entertaining, I don't want to entertain anyone. If you want to watch us play, that's cool. You're invited to. But, you know, I don't want to tell the crowd to do things. And
you don't want to tell them to put their hands up and wave.
No. Yeah. I just always thought that was goofy when I was little. You know what I mean? Like, don't get me wrong, though. Like, Sick of It All, be like, I want you guys to fuck it up. And I'm like, that is so awesome. You know what I mean? But, you know, say, whoa. Like, I don't know. It's just, I'm not against it. But, you know, I just personally don't want to do it. So, you know, when we were very proud that Asian Men Records would consider us, because Mike is like an Ian MacKay, you know, like he, MacKay, MacKay, whoever, like whoever you are and whatever way you say it. Like, you know, he's one of those guys. So it was very organic. I've never used that word in music. Organic thing to do. And it was really nice of him to say he likes our music. So we felt part of a team. You know, we felt part of like a group of guys, like we got to put Asian Man Records on the back of our t-shirts. So that was really cool, but still there was no sort of like powwow, like we got to do these things to make it big. It was more like, guys, you want to go to England? That's going to be so fun for us to do together. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So no, we get serious. Like you can't be wasted on stage and, you know, you can't, you know, like, let's try, you know, we're good at running Big D, you know, we're good at going on tour, we're good at, you know, we're serious about doing a good job, but getting bigger and being a big band, we like being in the middle. You know, to a big band, we're small, but to a small band, we're big. We're like the Anthrax of ska.
I want to step back just a second. You like rehearsals?
I love rehearsals. I like rehearsals more than shows.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Well, I mean, rehearsals are the best. You're playing music with your buddies. I mean, oh, that's the greatest. like going on stage and stuff, I don't know. It's cool. I like that people love it. But when I'm on stage, I'm just trying to pretend it's the rehearsal room.
You know what I mean?
I'm trying to just be like, there's people here, but, you know, they're just watching. I don't know. Yeah, you know, I don't want to be an entertainer.
So I'd heard a story that you guys were big Skank and Pickle fans. True or false?
Mark Flynn was a huge Skank and Pickle fan.
Okay. But I'd heard that you guys drove all the way out to the West Coast to play a single show so that Mike Park could see you guys play.
That does sound like something we would do. because you have to understand, like, we would be like, wouldn't it be fun to travel together? You know what I mean? So that does sound bold, and I'm going to check. I'll check. Mark's in China right now. That's where he lives now.
What?
Yeah, and so I'll ask him. Yeah. It does. Something about that sounds familiar.
That was the story I remember about around Mike putting out your record.
It also sounds like we would instinctually want to book some shows.
You know what I mean? Right, right. And that was my thing too with the story also. It was always like, wait, they just drove all the way out and then all the way back? No shows on the way?
I think it was that we drove all the way out, played that show, and played some shows on the way back.
Okay, that makes a little bit more sense.
I'll check on that though. But I want to go back, if you don't mind, to like live shows. Like, you know, I do like it. It's just that I get nervous. Do you know what I mean? Like, as a drummer, you get your instrument and you're back there. And, you know, that's where I come from, being a drummer. You know what I mean? And so you get to hang out with your drum set and just hammer it. You know what I mean? And it's wonderful. But walking up in front of all those people, And when Big D played most of our shows, it's when people didn't like ska. So, you know, take it from like 19, whatever, like let's say he died in 99 or 2000, you know, for almost 10 years of playing, when we would get up on stage, you know, people would be like, oh, Jesus, a ska band. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, a lot of my like molding has to do with, where do they get a load of this? You know, like that old 16, 17 year old mentality of like, I'm going to blow your ears off. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, I could definitely see that being, you know, the front person in the band, you draw all the attention to you on stage. And if you have an instrument, you can kind of, if the show's not going how you plan, you can really just bear down and focus on the instrument. If you're just up there with a microphone, everybody's looking at you. And so right. anything that you want to do up there is like under a microscope a little bit.
Yeah. That's why I kind of just go in my own world, and I'm really just in the song. While I'm in the song, like I think about when we wrote the song, I think about all the excitement about the song, and I'm just really sounds kind of hippie-ish, but like, you know, I'm just in the music, and sometimes I look at the crowd. If the crowd is I connect with the crowd, don't get me wrong. I mean, of course. But the crowd doesn't come first. You know what I mean? Mm.
When you released Good Luck, that was sort of the period of time where you were really starting to see ska going out of favor. So right when you guys are basically debuting yourself to the world, that's when it's happening.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, you guys had kind of got to the point where, you know, you'd gotten a deal with Asian Man, now ska is kind of becoming a dirty word right at the same time.
I describe it as someone told you to go to a party, and right when you got there, the cops came and everybody left. And now you're in the house, now you're in the party house, and it's empty. You know what I mean? Like, everyone's like, Friday night, we're going to the party, get there. And we're like, can't believe we're going to the party. And they're like, cops are here. And we're like, where'd everybody go? This is supposed to be a fun, where'd everybody go? You know?
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, thank you. It's exactly what it was. And it was a lot of confusion, like scratching your head going like, what happened?
But, you know, for the next decade, you did well, though, for a period of time where ska was the butt of a joke, where people were trying to flee from the scene, pretend that they never played in a ska band. Like, Big D did well.
Now that, like, the party's back on, looking back, it is quite incredible. You're right. The whole time, we're playing the number one least favorite style of music and having a blast and getting people to want to listen to us and show up to shows globally too, you know, because we're in America, so we know the American scene. But I mean, in England, with Household Name Records and Cap Down and the Foamers and Lightyear and Five Knuckle and Sonic Boom 6, like there's a huge scene, you know what I mean? So like,
yeah.
That scene was still kicking it. And you know, so yeah, looking back, we did do such a good job during the driest period of yeah. Like meaning like drowning in a lake, but keeping the flag up. You know what I mean? Like we waited in the water until people came and rescued us. You know what I mean? Or people cared to see us drowning, not drowning, but it's a shaking mountain. We didn't falter. We held the flag until it was cool again.
Nice. And you're back. You're back now that other people are holding the flag too.
Well, I want to go back a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about Household Name Records, because I was also, you know, Blink 80 put out a split with Cap Down, and I wanted to ask, what was your relationship with Household Name?
Lil and Catherine, the head people, really, 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 really good. Just like, you know what they say, like a family, you know, just good friends. It's just like what you used to read about in like with Discord and Outlook. I mean, Lookout. Oh my God. That's dyslexia right there. A Lookout. And just being part of an underground music scene that is trying to do its best and doing a good job.
Yeah. Of those Household Name bands, if you had to pick one that you think is like the least well known that should get more attention, who would you pick?
Lightyear. Lightyear is brilliant. And Chaz and I, we started a band together with Paul and Ryan from Big D called the Alley Oops. And I am quite, quite honored to even be considered in a band with Chaz. I mean, he's out of this world talented.
and also out of his mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been on.
I need you to just tell your favorite Lightyear story really quick.
Once we were in Switzerland it doesn't matter, but this venue, and it's called like the Sierra or something like that. And Neil comes up to Chaz, and Chaz whips out something and pees in a pint glass till it's filled, and then Neil just takes it and just drinks it. And that's like nothing compared to like all the other stuff. It's like being on tour with 6 G.G. Allens, 9 G.G. Allens. You know?
Very sweet G.G. Allens.
Oh, very sweet. Very sweet. One of my favorite Chaz moments is he put makeup on in a dress. Neil and they're always wearing dresses, and you know, makeup smeared, and I remember having like this really good conversation about music, and just looking at Chaz and Neil, and just being like, these guys are just great, because they're just they looked like a girl at the end of a really sloppy date. Like, she drank too much, and you know, she might have thrown up a million times, but you're looking at this person going like, you are so brilliant, you know everything, and I agree with everything you're saying.
Man, I miss that whole crowd of bands. They're so good.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know what I miss? I miss this is gonna sound brutal. I miss really interesting people. You know what I mean? Like I think, not to the fullest extent, but I think once technology took over, I think there's different players on the field, meaning like, I think there were usually more artists, less like tech artists. You know what I mean? Like in the studio, when you'd be playing with tape, if there was tape, you know, often you'd hear like the guitar player say something like, shut up, I know, just play it again. I know how to do it. I'll count, shut up, just play it again, I'll get it. And they get it. Now, when a take happens, you hear people go like, is that enough? Can you fix it? Can you put it together? You know what I mean? So yeah. I think there was just like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to be one of those people that's like, it's different now. But I miss really artsy people. You know what I mean? Not people who are like in it for the business. You know, we can do this.
All those ska books.
Ska books.
All that buddy in ska.
Yeah. Jig D became friends with Melt Banana in the 2000s. This seems like an unlikely alliance. Tell me a little bit about that.
But going back in time to when I was like 16 or 17 years old, I'm going to a Melt Banana show in Boston. A Mr. Bungle show in Boston. And Melt Banana's opening up. Never seen him before. And I'm watching this band and I'm falling in love. I've never heard music like this. I knew metal, I knew hardcore, but I didn't know noisecore yet. I didn't know. And Melt Banana stops playing, and Yako goes, how come no one here likes Melt Banana, right? and my friends, they pick me up, and they bring me to the front of the crowd and, like, pretty much throw me on stage. And I kind of ask for the microphone, and Yako gives me the microphone. And I go, I don't know, I think it's going great. I mean, from what I can tell, everyone loves you guys. I mean, my friends love you. I'm just being really positive. You know what I mean? And then she's like, okay, thanks. And I'm like, okay. Later, I find out, many years later, when I introduced myself, I mean, when I was hanging out with them, I was like, you know, that was me at that Mr. Bungle show. And Agata, the guitar player, goes, oh my God, everybody come here. Do you know that Dave was the kid who Yako gave the mic to? And it was important because the band goes, we told her from that moment on, you are definitely not allowed to give the crowd the microphone. You know what I mean? So like we had met before in a weird way. And so now cut back to the Middle East, the whole band, we're all having lunch and I'm very nervous. And I wrote Deadpan Face from Strictly Rude about Yako. No, I don't usually write songs about people. And she was just cool, and she just had this deadpan face all the time. And like at one point, I made her laugh, and I was like, "I am awesome." And then cut to we do a split together, which totally annoyed the hell out of noisecore fans because we're a stupid ska band. But then it gets worse. We start playing shows with them. And, you know, the noisecore people are like, why are you on the show and not my band? You know what I mean? And it's like, because those are the better shows. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the Boss Zone's playing with Slapshot. You know, you don't want the same band opening up, you know? But not to be long-winded, but this is a big point. So we're settling up at the end, and I'm in the back where all the pans and dishes are with Yako. She's counting some money out. And she goes, you have a very cool voice. And that was the end-all, be-all of any sort of affirmation I've ever needed. It was quite a nice compliment.
That's what you get to put on your tombstone.
Exactly. Oh.
Can you tell us like a particularly cold moment of playing with Melt Banana, like the reception from their crowd?
No, I don't. I think it was okay. I think we had enough of our crew in there. I mean, opening up for the Dropkick Murphys in Germany is worse than that.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, I definitely will. But may I tell you that while we were sitting here, I got a text from a friend called Sean. And on the new record, I don't know if you know, but we have a song with Melt Banana. We did a song together.
What song's that?
It's called You Buggin'.
Oh, okay. That's why that song's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was listening to that. I was like, why is this song so weird?
It's so good.
That makes a ton of sense.
And we just finished shooting a video, a dual video, and he was sending me a cut of it. So we freaking have a dual song and a music video with Melt Banana. I mean,
wow.
I don't deserve this shit. I mean, this is like, some people are like, you know, Dave Grohl meets Paul McCartney and he's like, this guy's like my hero. Well, Yako's my hero and it's all happening for me too.
Okay, so Dropkick Murphys.
So playing with the Dropkicks is like this. Let's say you were going to a Major League Baseball game, right? But a minor league game is going to play first, right? Nobody wants to watch the minor league game. They just want to watch the major league game. You know what I mean? You know what I mean at all? Like, so nobody really wants opening bands for the Dropkicks. Or back in the day, they didn't. Maybe things are different now, but back in the day, we were on. Oh, who's that band? We were on tour with. I forget what their name, but some parts of Germany, you know, like they don't want you to play. They want you to be done. And I remember that whole tour being like really on edge, you know, because you had to prove yourself. Like you said, you're in that ska band, so like. I think I broke the drum monitor the first show of the tour and had to apologize to like everybody. And, you know, I was on edge. I was just very like, give me a reason. You know what I mean? And I always knew that I had to keep my eyes open or get beer thrown at me or, you know, you had to be careful. I mean, people love the show, but certain people would be aggressive enough to physically go at you. And so I remember closing my eyes once the whole tour in this song Find Out and getting like a full big can of Heineken smashed in my face. And I just remember thinking to myself, well, it's your fault, Dave. You knew the rule you gave yourself. Keep your eyes open. And what did you do? You closed your eyes. but you know, that's kind of like how my development, right or wrong, has come. You know, I like opening up. I like opening shows. I don't like headlining shows. Like I have a little harder experience when the crowd loves you than I do if the crowd doesn't like you. You know what I mean? So yeah, I mean, spending a lot of time going on tours like the Dropkicks and in a time when you're forever the nerd, you know, because, you know, I was, you know, kind of, I was an outcast when I was little, and then, well, you know, younger, if you will, and then you go on tour and you that same label is on you. You know what I mean? You're still the outcast. You're still the dork, you know? So I've never come to fully trust, you know, the crowd, not the crowd, but I'm just so used to being me.
So you did the very first Ska's Dead tour, right?
I'm not sure if it was. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So with Mustard Plug, Catch 22, Planet Smashers.
What a lineup.
I believe this was 2004 as well. This is kind of gets back to the dichotomy of what the state of ska was in the 2000s. On one hand, it's the least coolest music that you could possibly be affiliated with.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there is still a fan base for it. And to the constant shock of people outside of the scene. And I feel like Ska's Dead was the ultimate statement and example of that. I know that was Dave Musterplug. That was sort of his point behind the ironic title. And,
yeah.
And to then take, you know, like a handful of bands and to put all you guys together and put it in bigger rooms and kind of like blow minds and be like, hey, look over here. We got people coming out for ska shows. So tell me a little bit about what that experience was like for you. I mean, like Musterplug and, you know, they got to experience the 90s ska scene. And then, so for them, I imagine it was a little different, but what was it like for you guys?
Cause we didn't even know what they knew. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's tours like this. Perfect example, by the way. And I'll add Big Wig and Belvedere. And I'll add the tour that we did with the Lawrence Arms and MU330. So this is the start of Big D making friends. You know what I mean? Like we're making friends, like strong friendships with other bands like us. It's not just kind of like, you know, some shows, you know, you're going, people in bands know, like you're making those forever friendships, you know?
Yeah.
So it was probably the loveliest time of my life. You know what I mean? Just, you know, being on tours, we're ska bands. So there's about 50 of us and we all are friends. You know what I mean? I mean, not probably really 50, but you know what I'm saying? And so, yeah, just really realizing the love and the friendship and the similarities and everyone's really close and genuine, very genuine. It couldn't be beat. You know, those are the best. And those friendships, like with Musterplug and the Planet Smashers, Pie Tasters, Big Wig. I mean, you know, even like with Belvedere, which I haven't seen in forever, Scott, I see on social networks, like it'll be a life friendship. You know, it's not just like going on tour with someone and going high five, we kick ass. You know, it's really nice. And you know, I'm not trying to like put down myself or anything, but when you are part of being an outcast for so long, those things are really helpful.
You were kind of the Big D was like kind of the, well, the way I perceive it is that you were kind of the band that was like, here's the next generation, so to speak. And I mean, you were more up and coming at that point, but you had a lot of energy and you were making momentum, whereas they had more notoriety from the 90s. What was the energy of the crowd like? I don't know if you can think back to those shows.
I feel your question. It was like that. It was like we did feel new. What I love about that whole crew of bands is that, you know, that's the old chapter. And no matter what happens with the new wave of ska, we're still always the youngest of that chapter. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Or even how much older we get, we're still the youngest. So it's so fun. Yeah, they were all older than us. And we did have, like you said, just like the let's go for it.
I was curious what the energy of the audience was like from your point of view. I mean, because now you have like probably larger rooms with fanatical ska fans, because the people coming to these shows are diehards and they're in on the joke that ha ha ha, ska is dead. Not really.
Well, the Voodoo Glow Skulls, big part of Big D's life. Eddie said something to me once that really confused me. He goes, you guys are going to be the next big thing. I know this. But he meant like big. He meant like, you know, big time. And he goes, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Because, you know, my background with music, you know, is like heavy metal and hardcore and ska. And other than heavy metal is obviously heavy metal. But like when I was young, it was looked down upon like only drug addicts, you know, like heavy metal. It wasn't like played at baseball games and, you know, so popular now. So what I'm getting at is like, he's like, you're going to be the next big thing. And I'm like thinking in my head, like, God, I'm trying to put everything out there to not do that. why, I wonder what Eddie's talking about, but I outrageously respect him. I love his guitar playing so much. And so he's like, no, man, it's going to happen. And I know these things. And it was stuff like that that started making me get nervous. You know what I mean? Like, which ties into, I'll talk about the crowd in a second, but which starts to go into Strictly Rude. And it's just like, well, why are we getting popular if we're writing songs like Five Kids Down and those kids suck? And, you know, we're trying to write songs to be like, you know, not on this path. You know what I mean? So it's just so weird. I just remember Eddie saying that during these times and just being like, oh, how odd. But the crowd, I think during that time, you know, we were too punk for the ska kids and too ska for the punk kids, but we had our nucleus of hardcore listeners. And so we had that like really good, solid crew, but we didn't necessarily, because we were so new, we were breaking all the old rules. So none of the old dudes could really go, well, yeah, you know what I mean? They wanted like music like the Allstonians. The Allstonians are from Boston and Austin. They wanted like, you know, traditional or the Pie Tasters or the Slackers. Or if it was going to be punk ska, it would be nice if it was like Time Bomb. You know what I mean? But when you're playing Those Kids Suck and You're Me Now and these songs, you know, you're not going to sell your music to the 100% of the audience. So I still think it was rickety.
Let's transition then into Strictly Rude, because yeah, this was a moment for you guys. First, let's talk about the creation of the album. You had Joe Gittleman from Boston's produced. So what was that experience like, and how did that all kind of get set up?
So Kevin Lyman of Vans Warped Tour told Side, okay, so Big D's never really been helped, you know, like connections, like that was easy. That was easy to do that. We've never, but Mike Park, Kevin Lyman, Jay from the Suicide Machines did something really nice once, and Joe Goodobin, they've been nice to us. And Kevin Lyman told Side One Dummy, if you don't sign this band, you're crazy, because I've never met a more hardworking band. Like, if you've ever been to Warped Tour, they do this thing where they plaster posters all over the fences. I'm confident with saying that Big D was the first band to do this. Mm-hmm. And then slowly bands were hiring like street teams to do it for them. But we were the first person to like shepherd fairy the hell out of things. And so suddenly we're about to get on Side One Dummy, and a producer is coming in. So I was just like that classic, I don't know, little wild cat that was like, okay, we're gonna have a producer, but like, you know, I don't want things to, you know, I don't want to sell out, you know what I mean? You know, so I was a little like nervous at first, but that Joe was just so good. You know, he'd drive and pick me up. It was out of his way. Pick me up for the studio. I didn't have a car. And drive me there, and he made me realize, like, come on, man, it's not going to be like that. I'm not smoking a cigar going, you're going to have the, you know, it's not one of those classic things. We Strictly Rude was just outstanding. It was, I mean, it's after How It Goes in Beijing to Boston. So like How It Goes in Beijing to Boston were just so much fun. And now we're embarking on a new record, and we all live like on the same block, like the whole band, like pretty much lives on the same block. So we can walk to each other's houses and write. And, we just went into this rehearsal space. We had about 40 or 50 songs or ideas, you know, like ideas. And we just worked out that record. But as you can tell with that record, there's a lot of happiness, like Noise Complaint and Shining On.
Yeah.
And it was just a very potent time to like be crashing on people's couches, and your friends are like spilling out of every window in Alston. You know what I mean? You walk anywhere and it's just very artist, and like the cover. I mean, the cover is all of us hanging out at my buddy Pod's house where I would crash at. So it was a very happy time.
It almost seems like, I don't know if it's just like a you're capturing a moment of time and how it felt, but it almost feels like the album has a message in that sort of uplifting spirit of the songs.
Yeah, I mean, it really was like, you know, music, a steady riot in my soul was steady riot. And, you know, Noise Complaint again. All the things were happening. You know what I mean? Like Deadpan's on it. I just met my hero, Yako, and wanted to write a song about her. You know what I mean? And then Todd, my buddy, had just, you know, like we all have the guys who become an alcoholic first, and he just left, you know, and, you know, it's a very beautiful in your 20s time. Everyone's getting a girlfriend that they really love for the first time. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's stuff like that. Like, it's kind of like a Family Guy episode where he goes, yeah. Peter goes, yeah. You remember, like, going to the swimming hole with all your friends? You start to jog quicker because you can't wait to see them. And everyone's cheering your name. And, you know, like, it's just one of those moments in life.
So you truly, like, you can think back to that time period when you wrote those songs that it just felt like a happy period of your life?
Yeah, I mean, Flute and Stroll, I would say, was happier. But this was more like that potent, yo, Todd, let's go to the bar. And, like just very, I don't know, like, licking your canines 23. You know what I mean? Just like, rawr, we're young. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, it was a silly time. Like, I collected cans from the house I lived in because everybody drank so much to bring them down to this local place to be able to get a sandwich for lunch. But that was my routine. You know what I mean? It was just weird stuff like that. You know, I like slept on couches and they had bed bugs and you got about 5 bites a night. but the recording was quite wonderful with Paul Coldry, Adam Taylor, Adam and Alex Taylor and Adam, Joe, and people caring about your music for the first time. Like you have an engineer, a producer, and two like second engineers. You know, like Alex Hartman showed me who the Equals was there, then the band The Equals. And, you know, so we're going into a recording studio with friggin' guy from the Boston's. You know what I mean? It's it's crazy, you know?
I'm curious if you, as an adult, you know, if you ever go back and listen to this record and if what it makes you feel like listening to it years later.
Well, I think that's a big part of records. Like if Big Deep puts out a new record and any band puts out a new record and the fans or the listeners, I'm sorry, go, you know, I don't like it. There's, you know, and there's something missing, right? You know, people need to understand that if something's missing from a new record, sometimes it's your memories. You know what I mean? Like hanging out with Chris, going to Tanya's house. You know what I mean? Like there's something missing in the songs and it's memories. And so if you don't give a new record for a band you love the chance to have your memories, then you're never gonna like that record, you know? So yeah, when I go back and listen to the Strictly Rude, I have cupboards of memories just blasting open. And, you know, you can smell it, you can taste it. And so it's sometimes a lot, you know, it's sometimes a lot to take in, you know, almost too much because you're like, oh, Jesus, you know, like going through an old photo album.
I mean, when I listen, this could just be my own interpretation, but when I listen to Shining On,
yeah,
to me, that's like a song about choosing to be happy, even though maybe life, it doesn't, there's reason to not be happy.
Yeah.
But that's like a decision, not necessarily, you know, so that almost suggests to me not necessarily that life is grand, but more like an attitude of choosing happiness in the face of struggle.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, all those things mentioned in the song, you know, happened. I was actually talking about the wine smashing at my local packy store just the other day because they were like, do you want me to double bag it? And I was like, you know, I once walked out of a wine store and it broke. You know, I was telling them the story. I didn't say anything about the song, but I was just telling them, like, yeah, that didn't happen. And they were like, yeah, we'll double bag it. A lot of people applaud me a little bit for being positive, right? And I find that, you know, I find that very kind for them to say, but also very worrisome that, you know, I'm just like everybody else. I'm just worried how everybody else is doing if I'm somehow this person who's really positive. And you know, where my positivity comes from in the working hard for a good moment kind of you were alluding to is two things. One, you know, not to get into it, but when the Gulf War happened, my mom was really worried because she kind of just knew how dominoes fall. And she was just really worried that it would turn into something where I, at my age at the time, would have to go to war. So I just remember because I was in middle school. So you have to keep an eye on those things. And so I was really lucky. You know, if you think about World War One, Two, and the Korean War, and the Vietnam and the Korean War, you know, she had seen all her friends go to the Vietnam War. So I always look at myself as just very, 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 very lucky that I never had to go to war, because at one point I thought maybe that would be something I would have to do. And whenever I watch movies like, you know, Saving Private Ryan, The Lot, you know, I'm just very, very happy. And I empathetically think about often, you know, I'm not sitting with my hands on my stomach in mud, trying to hold my stomach together, wishing I was with my mom. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what so many people at my age at the time, that's their story. And so if historically, the fact that I didn't have to go to war is so grand that, yeah, I don't really let a lot of things bother me too much. I don't want to be a little gossip that's moaning about this and that and the other thing. I'm not comfortable. Everything's not perfect. You know, I mean, you're alive, you know? So that's where that comes from. But then also, I have to move rooms because my computer might die. Then the other thing is, you know, I'm dyslexic. And so, you know, I've had to work much, much, much harder in school than people who have a natural ability. So, you know, I would have to work really hard for the B on the grade, or, you know, stuff like that. So I know what it's like to have to work really hard. And so, yeah, it's just been a, I just don't moan like people do.
Yeah. I mean, happiness to some extent is a decision. And I think that's something that is not broadcast in our culture.
No. I mean, I know people have kept, of course, depression is a different thing. And I'm not, anybody listening, I'm not saying.
For sure.
You know, it's a chemical thing that you can't just snap off. But it also comes back why I'm in ska music. And that's, you know, when I was in high school, I told this in the Ska's and Annie story, but, you know, I was in my car and getting in my car, and it was winter and I didn't want to go to school and sucks and sick of it. But then I put on the Operation Ivy dubbed cassette I had, and I would be happy. And I remember being so appreciative of that they could do that for me, that I remember being really young and going, this is exactly what I'm going to do because I appreciate it. So yeah, I mean, you know, but I'm one of those people that literally can't believe that I can watch Star Wars anytime I want, if I choose. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many amazing things. I'm surprised people moan so much.
So Noise Complaint, though, that was probably your biggest song then?
I don't know. I thought, it's hard. I would have thought Shining On.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Well, between the two, we have probably your biggest two songs.
But then I ask you this, could LAX beat them? Like, is LAX more known? I don't know. I don't know the answer.
We're going to have to find out.
Yeah.
So you shot the Noise Complaint and the Shining On video. Did you shoot them at the same time? Because the Shining On is like sequel, I guess, a video sequel.
It was a weekend. And that's the Side One Dummy office that we're in.
Okay.
But the funniest story about that is we shot like Noise Complaint.
And so if anybody hasn't seen Noise Complaint, it's just like a big party.
Yeah.
It's like a big party. Yeah.
And so after that, we go to a bar to kind of go like, hey, we just shot a video. And we're hanging out at the bar. And this guy starts talking to me. He's like, who are you guys? And I explain everything. And he goes, oh, that sounds really awesome. Congratulations about, you know, the video. And I go, he goes, are you happy with it? I go, I am. But tomorrow we're shooting another video and I'm a little disappointed. And he goes, why? I go, because I wanted a red station wagon to be in the video. Now, you have to understand, I've never seen a red station wagon. I didn't even know they came in red. Like, usually they just come in that, like, you know, wood siding kind of thing. And he goes, are you fucking with me? And I go, no. And he goes, someone told you. And I go, what? He goes, I have a red station wagon. And I go, you too? He goes, yeah, it's called Moose. You want to use it? You can use it tomorrow. And I was like, yeah, sure. That's great. Isn't that crazy?
That is. And so the beginning of Shining On, was that filmed? Because it's, you guys are in this, right? You're in the same space and it's like you're all like worn out from the partying, basically.
Yeah.
Did you film that at the same time or did you begin that the next day?
I think it was the next day. Dan Doby, the director. Yeah. I think we did all of Noise Complaint and then did Shining On the next day, which was like Friday, Saturday. Dan Doby, the director, who's brilliant, whose brother with Rob Doby, the illustrator, art guy, he has that mentality, which I kind of have too, which is like, okay, we're going to do this, but what else? What else? We're going to do this, but what else? What else? What else? What else?
If you're okay talking about it, I'd like to ask you about, in 2011, you got thyroid cancer. Is that something you, don't mind talking about?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So first up, how did you know? Were you getting symptoms or was it just like a routine checkup?
I got an interesting question. So we're going to Japan for the first time and I was complaining about like sore throats or something. Mm-hmm. And, my mom was like, I didn't have health care because America's ridiculous and I was touring too much. You know what I mean? I didn't have like a job, you know? Or I did, but it would be like intermittently waiting tables or bartending, which doesn't give you health care. And so she's like, you need to sign up for Mass Health, which was at the time Romney Care in Massachusetts. And I was so excited about Japan that. I was kind of just like, you know, I wasn't really like getting the paperwork done right away. And she's like, look, do it. And I was like, all right. And so I did it. Then I went to Japan and could barely sing. And I was like, wow. Oh my God, this sucks. I've been trying to get to Japan for so long and now I'm here and I sound terrible. That's really a disappointment. And then we go right to Europe and she goes, you can go to Europe, but we're going to get your test results done while you're on the tour. And if you have cancer, you have to promise me you'll come home. And I was like, okay, because I don't have cancer. And so I went on the tour and we were like, oh, so it was my birthday and we were supposed to go to Paris, but we made a wrong turn. Like we messed up on the GPS. So instead of my birthday being in Paris, which I was very excited about, we were heading towards like Spain or Italy. I just forget. And we were going to somewhere else. And it was like, it's still my birthday and we're driving late in the night and there's no alcohol on any of the rest stops. So I'm just kind of like sitting there in the dark in a van going, this sucks. And then I get to the hotel and my sister emails me and she goes, mom doesn't want to let you know, but you have cancer.
So wow.
I was like, oh, what a birthday.
So how old were you?
I don't know anymore. I'm not sure. Not really sure.
Okay.
I kind of like during that whole time, I didn't really retain information. I just kind of like went through the steps. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I was just kind of like, yeah, just tell me where to go. And they're like, and people would be like, you know, I researched this and did you know? And I'm like, I don't need to know. You know what I mean? I was just like, it's going to work out or it's not going to work out. That's how I'm gonna.
So you weren't like terrified when you got the news?
Yeah, no, definitely. I call it the darkness. You feel like my friend Stu in Boston recently just died of cancer, and so there was a benefit show with Bane and the Bouncing Souls, and going to that show, I felt the darkness coming back. Like you can feel it. Like some people, you know, like death, like the figure of death. I think people invent that because that's what it feels like. For me, it more feels like one of those things in Harry Potter that guards Azkaban, a Dementor. And it kind of feels like a Dementor, which is pretty much like death. And it's very big feeling. And it's kind of like the sting of cold, but not the cold of cold. Like you feel it like silk come over your shoulders, like it's back. Like he's back, you know, when you've had cancer and you have to deal with someone else having cancer, it's like it's back. And so, yeah, Lights Out is very sad. And so I didn't want lights out. I wanted to live longer. And I was very sad that there was a possibility that, you know, and then when you have had cancer, you know, I'm always worried he's going to come back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I have to say, I joke around that I had drive-through cancer. Like, I had radiation, don't get me wrong, but I didn't have chemo.
Did you guys catch it early? Is that what happened?
We caught it early enough. Like, so they took out all of my thyroid, not some of it. And when they take it out, there are these things called satellite cancers, like just little, and the cancer didn't go to my lymph nodes, which a lot of people know. So I was just, all the things, you know, like when doctors tell you, you want this and you don't want this. We got the, you want this.
You got the good prognosis.
Yeah. So, you know, the radiation burned all the satellite cancers. Getting radiation is crazy. People can't be next to you more than like, you know, 3 or 5 minutes. And everything you touch has to be destroyed. It's crazy.
What?
Yeah.
Like, wait, what?
Yeah. Like if you use bed sheets and like towels, like while you're taking radiation pills, they have to be destroyed. It's like the most X-Men I've ever been.
How long? Wait, what? I'm sorry. I've never had to deal with this. Yeah. So, you know, but how long? What's the time period for that?
I think it's like maybe like a couple days or a week while the pills are in you. What's really funny? Wow. What's really funny is there's this huge pageantry to give you the pill. Like the doctor's dressed in all this kind of like radiation gear, and the pill is in this kind of like, it kind of looks like the stones from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, but they open up and they're steel. And then when you open the steel container, it's just a little pill. And then the doctor has to bring like a young doctor with them. Cause if you're a young doctor, you have to go through this procedure to get your check mark that you've done this. You know what I mean? Like not an internship, but like a merit badge for doctors. And so you got this like intern and everyone's taking it really seriously. And you're sitting there like with your stupid band t-shirt on going, all right, guys, just give me the pill. But it sucks. It's very scary. And I really, what I'm left with is when I hear that people get cancer, even if it's a commercial, it's heavy because you feel very bad.
Yeah.
The obviously, you know, you got the best result in that the cancer was taken care of. But so you don't have a thyroid anymore? Is that the end result though?
Yeah, so I have to take thyroid pills, and so that's kind of a bummer for me because, you know, a lot of my life I like living off the grid, and I like not being part of society 100% by touring. But now I need this pill so much that if like the zombie apocalypse comes, like I have to like bust into a pharmacy and like that's the first thing I have to do. You know what I mean? Like I need these pills. You know what I mean?
What would happen if you didn't have pills?
It's kind of like powering down. You just start powering down.
Wow.
Yeah. So like if I forget to take one, I'm like, what's going on?
You know, like you have no energy.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah. Okay.
But like a weird hollowness. It's not even like being tired. It's like this weird hollow. Your body feels hollow. And that's what really disgusts me about some practices in America, in that, like, you know, I can't get these, you know, with our healthcare system, it's like, it's ridiculous. It's like, they don't even care. You know, I had to fight so long just to get more than seven pills at a time. You know what I mean? Like, the system is just so stupid. You know, it's like, dude, I need that.
Definitely.
I need that very much. And $20 says the people writing the laws like think they believe in God.
We'll almost circle back. We'll talk about the new album a little bit.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like the new album has a lot of material on it, and it feels like it goes in a lot of different directions, both stylistically and just the tone of the songs. I don't know if you have, if it's too soon to have any perspective on it, but do you have any thoughts on, like we talked about the sort of what Strictly Rude, where it was coming from and what it kind of signified, but Do you have any thoughts about this new record in that same in that same sense?
Well, absolutely. Like, well, Big D's never been a band that wants to or could write an album that pretty much all the songs sound the same. You know what I mean? Like, the album is one song. And I'm not saying I don't like albums like that. I love albums like that. Like the Ramones. You know, if you want to put the Ramones on, it's the Ramones, you know? And Andrew WK's first record, Party Hard, it's Party Hard. You know what I mean? The whole thing. You know what I mean? But we really try to, you know, spark creativity in all of us. Like, you know, I don't want to be like, I wrote all the songs. You know what I mean? Like, that's not fun for me. Like, you know, like Dan, our old trumpet player, who's like not a songwriter. We're like, Dan, write a song. You can do it. We'll just, you know, like we try to encourage each other to write songs so that we're all writing songs together. You know what I mean? So when you do that, often the songs sound different. You know what I mean? You don't just have one person churning out sausages. And so, so again, a lot of our songs are different, but I decided to kind of add two things that I wanted to add. One is those sample tracks. There's about four of them. And I've always just been into that. You know, I grew up on the Beastie Boys and, you know, the Dust Brothers and all that stuff, DJ Shadow and DJ Crush and stuff. And so that's a huge part of what I love in music. And so I like films. I like Quentin Tarantino. So I watch a lot of what he is inspired by, like old B movies from the 60s and stuff. And so a good Saturday night for me is watching old weird movies and trying to find hilarious dialogue. You know what I mean? It's just fun for me. I've always done it my whole life. And so those tracks are fun, but they have a reason. They clean the ear palate, if you will. I know there's not a palate in here, but they clean the ear palate from one song to the other. You can't really go from New Day to You Buggin'. You need something in the middle to kind of, you know, reset you. And then I really like these short songs because, you know, everyone's such a smarty pants these days that, you know, like how many 3 minute, if someone's going to go on your Spotify channel, it's like, how many 3 minute songs are they going to watch? I mean, listen to, you know, like the short songs are to have fun and break up if someone's on a good car trip listening to Spotify, you know?
Where did you pull the samples from? Give us some examples.
Oh, She Devils on Wheels, Just for the Hell of It. These are movie titles. My favorite one is I got it from Something Weird Video, which is
Weird. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, it's like the best site ever. My favorite is Blast Off Girls. That's one. Is a recording of this guy who talks to you in between movies at a drive-in. You know what I mean? He's like, okay, you know, next we have Teenagers from Outer Space who bring a giant lobster to Earth. That sounds good. And next week we got this one with the scientist with a huge lab system. You know, he's like, don't forget to put your speakers back. We do have your candy bars and hot dogs. You know, he's just such a jolly great guy. I mean, I've never laughed as loud by myself than to this man talking. And so, yeah, just movies like that.
So 8 years ago was your last album of original music. I mean, a lot's happened in the last 8 years, both, you know, I'm sure personally and like politically and socially. Where were you at when you were writing these songs? More, I guess, more from a emotional slash, you know, what you felt you wanted to communicate point of view.
That's a great question. Well, what's interesting is, you know, during the Trump years, I'd already gone through the Bush years, and I knew one thing. I didn't want to write anything about Trump because I didn't want his ass stain on any of my records. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
we have that one song, President, and it's about Bush. Even though I like the song, I know the image of that guy's face is a part of that song for me. You know what I mean? So I don't want to look at Trump's face. I don't want Trump to have anything to do with Big D. You know what I mean? They can be separate subjects. And the other thing that I noticed for me, I'm not saying other people, because, you know, Suicide Machines wrote some kick ass political songs on their last record. But for me, you know, I'd been suckered into a couple online arguments, you know what I mean? Thus You Buggin'. And I almost feel like, you know, I didn't want to write another, you know what I think is wrong, when everybody who's not even in a band is writing what is wrong. You know what I mean? Like the punk rock message can start sounding like a Facebook comment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I didn't want any of our punk rock sounds to sound like a Facebook comment. You know what I mean? And so, but I still love punk rock. So I had to kind of like back up and be like, well, shit, you know? And so I just went back to the Dead Milkmen and, you know, and just their mindset. And, you know, there's this movie I mentioned before, like Revenge of the Nerds and Revenge of the Nerds 2. And the Nerds have a band in Revenge of the Nerds 2. And they don't sound anything like Metal in the Microwave from the record. But I almost feel like they could have written Metal in the Microwave. You know what I mean? In some like fantasy comic. So what I'm getting at is like, I still wanted to play punk rock music, but I didn't want to talk about him. I didn't want to talk about the situation, probably because it was upsetting me so much. So I tried to make our punk songs fun because I thought that would be better for people and for myself.
I want to ask about Scully Beanuts of the East Coast Bitch.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I recently, let me ask you something.
Yes.
I have Porch Life prepped for Spotify. You know what I mean? And I'm just not pressing the button.
Why not?
I don't know. It's like, I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it after this record comes out. I'm going to put it on there because the public deserves it. We all deserve it. But I just didn't want, like, man, when a hater, we don't have, Biggie doesn't have many haters, but when they, I mean, you know, like those people who go after you. But yeah, I just don't want any friggin' trouble.
What about Drexel?
Oh, God, he's great. So every year I try to get Drexel to reunite.
Uh-huh.
And right before lockdown, I pretty much did it the first time. I got it. Creep Johnson, Aaron Sinclair, said yes. And we got an offer from the Sinclair, which is funny. And it was all about to happen. And he canceled. Yeah. Yeah, so... I think that was, I do it every year. I try really hard. I love those guys. I pretty much stopped playing drums professionally because Mark and Aaron are like my guitar players. Like they challenge me and like, I just don't want to play if I'm not going to be playing at that. It'd just be boring. And so, I almost had it and it would have been so good. So fun.
What do you call the punk beat?
Oh,
like do that, do that, do that, do that. What do you call that?
I just call it punk. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The boots and cats and stuff.
Yeah, boots and cats.
But you know, after Drexel canceled that glorious, wonderful reunion show, that's when I quickly said to Todd, the bass player, "We got to do the Cuidado project because." I was so in drum. I got my chops back up. I was like ready. Mm. And so that's one of the reasons why Cuidado, a side project that I did with Todd.
Nice.
Cause we were all excited for the Drexel thing.
You had to use those chops somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to say one more thing about Cuidado is like Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys MCA died and Mark Sandman of Morphine had died quite a long time before. And so like I was saying earlier, like sometimes I get worried that wonderful artists with really great sounds are going to get forgotten. So, you know, MC had a really signature bass sound. So we wanted to make that part of Cuidado as an homage. And then we only have Barry and bass sax as an homage to Mark Sandman. And Dana Colley, who plays Morphine, actually played the bass sax in the Morphine record, which was like, you know, the coolest thing.
Yeah, that's rad.
Yeah. And Cuidado's getting put out by it's getting put out in China. We have a record, but it never got put out by anybody because we're not pretty enough. but it's going to be released in China and a split in the US.
So speaking of labels, Fork in Hand, is that still a thing?
It's not. What happened to Fork in Hand was we were doing really great, Steve Foote and I, and it you know, we never took money for it. We just always put it in the artists, of course. And so we just kind of used profits to put out more records. But what happened was we signed like whatever the two or three bands, the last bands were we signed, they all, after their record came out, they all quit. They all broke up.
Like as the record came out?
Yeah. Like some of them like knew they were going to do that. Like
oh, they just wanted amazing.
The record. Yeah. So the artists, the last artists destroyed the record or the label, but not the Stray Bullets. The Stray Bullets was, I would say, the last like real awesome fork in hand. Yeah. It was too bad.
Yeah, definitely.
We were killing it. Did you notice the fork in hand, two fork in hand posters in the Too Much video? They're in there.
No, I'll have to keep an eye out for those.
Yeah, yeah, they're in there. At the end, yeah. I was like, get a load of this. Yeah, I still got these posters.
Okay, so you covered Ska Sucks in 2016, I believe?
Yeah, that was a joy.
Now, had that been a part of your life set, or was that just did you just decide to do it?
Just love the song. Love that record.
Yeah, so what was your take on the song when it was released?
Oh, definitely at first I was like confused, like, so did they like ska? You know what I mean? Like, I definitely didn't understand. But I didn't really care to understand because I kind of knew that, you know, punk is brash and sarcastic and, you know, trying to egg you on.
So what led you to record a cover of it in 2016?
Kind of just like how cool the song was. And I kind of, it'd be nice. It was too, you know, cool the song was. Kind of fun idea to put a real message to you, Rudy, in it.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
And poke back in jest. You know what I mean? Like the last verse I rewrote, and I think it's pretty funny.
Yeah. Do you know the lyrics off the top of your head for the last verse?
I do think it goes, "Ska sucks. I only own Propagandhi's old stuff. Fat records bands go ching ching ding bop." That mic is never fucking like their style. It's so fun.
Amazing.
I know. Yeah. You say this joke out to the world, and it's crickets, and you're like, it's funny.
So is it true? Is it true though? Does Fat Mike not like your stuff?
Well, I've sent Fat Records every single release we've done since like 96, you know?
Okay.
I even took like this bear and stuck Drexel CDs up its butt and put like, of course they didn't like it, but fake blood all over it and stuff. And like I've tried all these different ways of doing it. You know what I mean? But the only time I've ever seen Fat Mike side stage is when we were playing a Flute and Stroll show. And like, you know, I don't know Fat Mike well, and so it's like, if he ever was gonna like Big D, it wouldn't have been then. You know what I mean? But you know what I mean, it would have been in some other time. But you know, it's just one of those. Big D has always had a very big has always had trouble getting a date to the prom. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, and it's not being part of the cool crowd, not no one ever patting you on the back and going like, I see you. You know what I mean? And so it's just turned into a funny thing. You know what I mean? Like
yeah,
he,
yeah.
But like he shouldn't, I'm not saying like, you know, he's his own person. We're just making a joke. We're in no way are we like, he should like us. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're not saying that at all. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
We're just saying like, you know, I asked Heather out 3 times and she said no each time. Nah. You know what I mean? Like, doesn't think I'm pretty.
Fat Mike is just not that into you.
Yeah, he's just not as cup of tea. Which is fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. It's fine as you bite your nails down. It's fine. It's no big deal. Not like I'm empty from all those bands that are doing all those fun things. It's fine. Well, it's like punk rock bowling. Like, we're not invited. It's like, can we go? You know? It's like, we're not that bad. We'll tune up.
We'll tune up.
I've told a story about you a bunch of times, Dave, to people where we played a show together and you like jumped up. There were these girls looking through this window and you like jumped up and put your ass against the window and broke the window.
Yeah. Pearl Street, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I cut my finger on the way down. I remember that. Do you remember that? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you still have a scar from that?
I don't think so, but I remember like the whole thing being fine. And then like, yeah, it was fun. And then while I was like pushed down, cutting my finger open, which I don't care about, but being like, ah, shit, you did it again. Yeah, I remember because they were like, well, that's always weird when you're doing something. And then like people walking by are like, oh, look at those fun people. I was like, get out of here, ladies. Big D got in our first brawl, 12-minute brawl outside Pearl Street.
Wow, how'd that go?
We ended a tour, and we just wanted to go home. The show was over. We just wanted to go home. We were really excited, and I was making a joke like I got in my like sleep clothes, aka pajamas, and I was saying to the man like I'm just gonna wear my pajamas now because we're gonna get home at like 4:45, so it's like I won't be ready for bed. You know, so I'm like we're just joking around, and then like a group of like six people, young adult dudes started just like they wouldn't let us not fight them. You know what I mean? Like we just kept saying no, oh no, guys, and it was just because of like they didn't like our style of ska. I mean, they were still people who liked ska. Like we probably owned the same freaking records. You know what I mean? And so we really were just like no. The whole time we were like no. And then they started sucker punching and headbutting and blowing out lips and noses. So we did a great job. But it lasted a long time. It lasted like 10 or 12 minutes, which is a very long time for a fight. And people were thrown into cars, people were thrown into windows, like where people were dining, and it just wouldn't stop. And then the cops came and the guys ran off. And, you know, as cops go, you know, like we're all in trouble. And my quote was like, officer, look at me. I'm in my pajamas. I'm trying to go home. Like, I don't want to fight these kids. But it was just unfortunate. But I just mention it because it was at Pearl Street and it lasted for so long. I just never been part of a fight that was like, ugh.
Yeah, usually it's like 30 seconds and it's done.
Yeah, it was like a John Wick film where like it kept going. It was nothing like a John Wick film.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the show wherever you normally download podcasts. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It's at In Defense of Ska. You can also sign up for my newsletter at aaroncarnes.substack.com. You will get the podcast sent directly to your inbox every Wednesday. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has a great band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram. It's simply @Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And on that note, we leave you by saying, ska now more than ever. Thank you.